Okay, so this is bio 241, and it is April 20th, and we're going to finish up chapter 13 today and move on to chapter 14. But more importantly, next time you do have a test, and it's going to be on 12 and 13, chapters 12 and 13, right? So this is the last chapter for the test. And we were looking at the cardiac cycle and justifying all these events in time, and that's why this diagram is particularly useful. Because what are some things that this diagram shows you? Versus time. It shows you blood volume of what? Volume of the ventricles. What else in the ventricles does it show you besides volume? Pressure, for instance, and it shows you electrical activity, and then it also shows you heart sounds and how they all relate to each other. So here is pressure. All right, so that's a mechanical event. That's when the heart starts to contract. And then here is the ECG. So this is a QRS complex. What does it? Oh, we didn't talk about QRS complex yet. We might have to come back to this slide. But that's an electrical event. And can you say that the electrical event, like this Q wave right here, does it happen at the same time as contraction? Or does it precede it?
Precede.
Yeah, it precedes. So the ECG precedes the mechanical events, right? That's just the signal for contraction. All right, and then this blue line, of course, should extend a little bit further to about this point before it drops below the aortic pressure. And when it does, that's when the aortic valve closes right here, and then you get that dicrotic notch. All right, on this diagram, it looks like the aortic valve should close right at about this point in time, and that's not true, right? So your lab book actually draws it better. So basically, the two major heart sounds that you have, right, the first and second heart sounds, closing of the AV valves, the atrioventricular valves, happens when does the AV valve close? Okay, that's the first one. That's when the pressure in the ventricles exceeds the pressure in the atria. And that happens during ventricular systole, right at the beginning of systole. That's when the AV valve closes, right? And then the second heart sound happens when, during diastole, when pressure in the aorta becomes higher than pressure in the ventricles, so blood starts to flow backwards from the aorta back into the ventricle, and that closes the semilunar valves. Okay, so those are the two major heart sounds. Okay. Heart murmurs. All right, so this is what we'd use a stethoscope to hear, and they're abnormal sounds produced by abnormal patterns of blood flow in the heart. Many can be produced by defective heart valves, and some of these can be congenital in origin, and other times they might develop due to an infection that you get later on in life, and sometimes you don't even know what kind of infection it is. Could be a bacterial infection, could be a viral infection. And even some drugs can damage valves. In rheumatic fever, damage can be from antibodies that are actually produced by the person's own body to fight the infection, and those antibodies will bind to the streptococcus infection, but they cross-react with heart tissue as well. So a person's own immune system is attacking a certain part of their heart. And also, chemotherapy agents might actually attack different parts of the heart as well. Right, so there are various things that can affect heart valves. So this other one is kind of interesting because of the cross-reactivity. You don't really think that your own body would attack part of your heart, but that's actually something that can happen. And for instance, dental caries, which are what? Caries are cavities, right? And they're produced by bacteria on teeth, and those bacteria then will metabolize sugars and produce acids, and those acids will etch the enamel away from a tooth. And here are a couple of bacteria, Streptococcus mutans and a class of Lactobacilli bacteria. And there are a number of people that have developed immunizations. You can be immunized against these kinds of bacteria, and you can become immunized against having dental caries. But there is a problem with that, and that is when you would get that vaccination, your body starts to produce antibodies, and those antibodies also cross-react with heart tissue. All right, so indeed you won't have any cavities, but you won't have a heart either. So those, the FDA has never allowed those immunizations to take place, obviously for good reason. Okay, so antibodies can react inappropriately. Okay, so heart murmurs can be due to a couple of different things. So not only does a valve have to close, but it has to open properly. If a valve doesn't open all the way, if it stays partially closed and blood is going to rush by that what we call a stenotic valve, and it's going to create turbulence, and you can hear that turbulence with a stethoscope. So that would be mitral stenosis, when the mitral valve becomes thickened and calcified, impairing blood flow from the left atrium into the left ventricle. And as a matter of fact, any valve can stenose. And then, since blood can't leave the atrium because the valve is not opening all the way, then that blood is going to accumulate in the left atrium, and that can cause, that's another reason for pulmonary hypertension. But anytime you have leftover blood in an atrium, it also has a tendency to form a clot. And of course, that's, you always want to be concerned about that, because you don't want clots just being generated in your circulatory system, because it could cause a stroke or a heart attack. Right. Instead of a stenosis, maybe some valves don't close properly. So stenosis means it doesn't open properly, but an incompetent valve or an insufficient valve is when they don't close properly. So when the ventricles contract, it produces high pressure, and blood is going to squirt backwards from a ventricle into an atrium, and it's going to make a squeaking or squirting sound. Right, just like if you were to blow up a balloon and then let the air escape, you hear like a little hissing or squirting sound. That's what an incompetent valve is going to sound like. And that could be due to damage to the leaflets or maybe to the papillary muscles. And that's going to kill the heart. So those valves have to be repaired or replaced. Okay, you can't live for a very long period of time. Other kinds of murmurs might be produced by other kind of defects in the walls of the heart. So for instance, here's the interventricular septum, here's the interatrial septum, and in utero, right, in the prenatal period, you're supposed to have a hole in the interatrial septum. And what is that called? What is that hole in the interatrial septum? Okay, that's the foramen ovale. Foramen is a hole, right? And this PFO right here just stands for patent foramen ovale. Patent means that it is open. And this happens to some people when they're born. The foramen ovale doesn't close completely, and it remains patent to some degree. And some people can even live till, well, maybe even in their 50s before clinical manifestations of a PFO manifest itself by heart failure. Okay, and the interesting thing about this repair surgery, it used to be open heart surgery, right, and you'd have to open up somebody's chest, but now it can be done orthoscopically, not everywhere, but a few hospitals can do it orthoscopically just by inserting catheters, and that was pioneered up in Stanford in Palo Alto, California. So that's pretty cool that you can do major heart repairs endoscopically. All right, not only can you have holes in the interatrial septum, but you can have a hole in the interventricular septum. And, of course, that's going to damage the left ventricle because it's pumping blood, but it's going backwards. You'd have an abnormal circulation. And you can see which way blood is going. So the question here is, why does blood always squirt from the left ventricle into the right ventricle? Is that believable? Yeah? Why is that? The left ventricle is a lot stronger, and remember I did show you a slide of some typical pressures. The left ventricle is what, it goes all the way up to 120 millimeters of mercury, but the right ventricle typically goes up to maybe 25, maybe 28 millimeters of mercury. So there's a lot higher pressure in the left ventricle, and so that's going to squirt blood over into the right ventricle. And again, it's going to make a squeaking or swishing sound when you listen to it. So that's pretty easy to pick up. Okay, any questions on that? Insufficient valves, stenotic valves, septal defects? Yeah.
What causes the calcification of the mitral valve?
Oh, what causes that calcification? You know, that's almost like a naturally occurring process. It can happen to people even in their teenage years, and we probably all have calcifications of valves. What could it be due to? Those calcifications might even incorporate a little cholesterol. So some people have problems building too much cholesterol in their body metabolically. That means they just have a genetic predisposition to it. Other people might have too much cholesterol in their diet. And it wouldn't surprise me if those calcifications are due to like subclinical infections actually of the heart valves. And then the other thing to remember is you've probably never seen a heart valve work in real life, but it's just taking a beating. Every time the heart beats, these things just slam closed, right, in just a fraction of a second. So there's a tremendous amount of friction and inflammation in that area anyway. And anytime you have a part of your body that's just being beat up like that, it has a tendency to develop inflammation and maybe calcifications or other kinds of scar tissues. Okay, but valves just really take a beating in your heart all the time. And of course, they never can take a break to recover. Okay, so all of those kinds of reasons might produce plaques on valves. Okay. Yeah, because it's just taking a bigger beating. And is that true? If someone has an infection, I'm not so sure if that's necessarily true, that the left is always more prone to disease than the right one. Okay. And if there are any congenital defects, maybe they're subclinical, maybe the valve is not insufficient, but if there are any pits or depressions in a heart valve, then that's just going to be an area for things to accumulate, especially bacterial infections, and that's probably an area that's going to calcify more readily than others. So if your valves are really strong and smooth, then chances are they won't disease, but if they have ridges or pits or something in them, then you're going to have a more of a preponderance to form a plaque in that area. Okay, and that's just congenital, kind of just what you inherit from your parents. Okay, electrical activity of the heart. Well, so we saw that nervous tissue has voltage-gated channels on it. What are voltage-gated channels good for? Like a sodium voltage-gated channel and a potassium voltage-gated channel. What are they used for in neurons, for instance? Yeah. Well, for depolarization, and the calcium and the potassium channel is for repolarization. Come on, you guys got to look alive here, right? Repolarization. So what do you call depolarization and then repolarization after that? That's an action potential. Yeah, that's the basis of an action potential, right? And axons have these kinds of channels, so axons can transmit action potentials, right? Long distances without degradation. And what did we see about skeletal muscle? Did you see any voltage-gated channels on skeletal muscle? Yeah, the sarcolemma has voltage-gated channels. So muscle fibers can propagate action potentials much like neurons can. Right? But I wouldn't say that the function of a muscle fiber is to transmit action potentials. It's just something that they share in common with neurons. What's the real specialization for muscle tissue? It's for contraction, right? It's the action potential is just the signal for contraction because of what you know now about excitation contraction coupling, right? So all muscle tissue kind of acts like nervous tissue because of those voltage gated channels, right? They can propagate action potentials over their surface. And the heart, since it's muscle, has these voltage gated channels as well. It's very electrical. And, of course, it's not specialized necessarily to transmit action potentials, but it is specialized to contract as well, right? But it is coordinated by that electrical activity by those voltage-gated channels on the membrane surface. Okay. So remember, myocardial cells, they're not long, but they're short, right? And they're branched, and they're connected with, what, intercalated discs. Yeah, oh, you know, do I have a picture of one here? Oh, I don't have a picture of one. All right, but that's not easy. That's not hard to draw. So, for instance, if I drew this cell right here, right? You could tell me this is, right? And here we can see, what am I drawing right here? Yeah, some striations, and then we see this muscle coming down over through here, right? And then we got another something here. We got something big over here, something big over here, and then another muscle cell, another. So these big thick lines represent what? Intercalated discs, right? And so these muscle cells are very short, and the intercalated discs are here for a number of different reasons, and that is when this cell contracts, it's going to pull on the neighboring cell, and you don't want it to just pull away from the neighboring cell. You want it to stay attached, and so there are special junctions in the intercalated disc to make sure that the cells stay attached to each other. That's one thing. The other thing is that it has these tunnels for sodium currents. What are those little tunnels called? Gap junctions, so that when one cell depolarizes, what happens to the neighboring cell? It depolarizes as well. And where does that depolarization go? It goes left and right, but where else does it go? Because of the branching nature of these cells, it also goes throughout the whole wall thickness of the heart, right? So that is important. And so myocardial tissue, because of those voltage-gated channels, will send action potentials throughout the whole myocardium. And because of that, we call the myocardium a functional syncytium, just means that all the cells are connected together and share information because even though they're specialized for contraction, they do share electrical information. So action potentials originating in any cell are transmitted to all others, with a couple little exceptions to that. All right, the atrial and ventricular chambers, though, are separated by non-conductive tissue, remember from anatomy, called the fibrous skeleton. So in the plane of the semilunar valves and the AV valves, and remember, what's that plane? It would have to be angulated this way and that way. That's the plane, because the heart is doubly angulated in your chest. All right. That's a fibrous skeleton, which is dense, regular connective tissue. It does not have voltage-gated channels. So the atria are electrically isolated from the ventricles. So electrical activity in the atria doesn't necessarily have to go into the ventricles. But we're going to see that there's one route where that does happen. Okay. Now, the heart by itself does not need innervation to contract because it is autorhythmic. It has nodal cells that spontaneously depolarize, and you saw another kind of muscle. What kind of muscle can depolarize by itself? Smooth muscle, yeah. And it would be, I think, what, a single unit smooth muscle. Right, it's spontaneously active and it can depolarize, and when it reaches threshold, then that smooth muscle is going to contract. Okay, the same thing for these nodal cells. Now these cells right here, they're colored kind of yellowish, that make them kind of look like nerves, but they're actually specialized myocardial cells that really don't contract. These really are specialized to conduct electrical impulses and spontaneously depolarize. The one that depolarizes at the fastest rate is the sinoatrial node, pretty much it's in the right atrium, pretty much at the junction at the superior vena cava. This one has the highest frequency of depolarization. So when it depolarizes, because of all the gap junctions, then that wave of depolarization sweeps over both atria, but it can't necessarily get into the ventricles because of what? The fibrous skeleton in this region right here. Okay. So the sinoatrial node, since it depolarizes the fastest and captures the heart rate, we call that the pacemaker of the heart under normal circumstances. So the heart is going to beat at whatever the natural rhythm of the sinoatrial node is. All right, that's the pacemaker. All right, so why does these nodal cells, why are they spontaneously active? All right, the membrane voltage begins at about minus 60, but does it look like a resting membrane potential? It's just not flat. It's just not at rest. All right. So here are some voltage-gated sodium channels right here. We call these HCN channels. So sodium is going to enter the cell, okay, and that's going to depolarize the cell depending on how many are open. And when it reaches this point right here, what happens? Okay, well, what do we call this level right here? This is? Yeah, that's a threshold, right? And when that happens, then there's voltage-gated calcium channels that open up. And where is calcium at high concentration? Outside the cell, it rushes in, further depolarizing the cell in a rapid manner. So here is the action potential on a nodal cell, for instance, in the SA node. Okay, and then the slower acting potassium channels open up and it repolarizes, and then the HCN channels, okay, allow for a little bit of depolarization until it reaches threshold again, and then the cell depolarizes. Okay, so, and this, because of this, this right here is what we call a pacemaker potential due to the HCN channels. All right, so that's why nodal tissue is spontaneously active, because they have these special HCN channels that are what? Always leaking ions. Okay, so it's going to reach a threshold. Okay, other tissues in the heart are spontaneously active. They don't really have a true flat resting membrane potential. All right, but the rate at which they depolarize is, or the slope, is not quite so great. Right, so maybe they're going to depolarize, but it's going to take a longer period of time. And so you can see then that this first action potential from the SA node then is going to cause depolarization in those other areas of the heart as well. So you're only going to have one pacemaker in the heart, in the normal heart. Okay. All right, so they're stimulated to produce action potentials by the SA node before they spontaneously depolarize. However, if we do something to the SA node, if we wipe it out, guess what happens? Then these other areas of the heart, right, will depolarize and form action potentials all by themselves, but at a slower rhythm. And then whatever part of the heart is the fastest, that will become the new pacemaker of the heart. Right, so if action potentials from the SA node are prevented from reaching other parts of the heart, then these other parts will generate pacemaker potentials and drive the rhythm of the heart. And you're going to see why that's important in just a second. Okay, so most depolarized to threshold by action potentials are arising from the SA node. All right, so those are nodal cells. There are other kinds of cells in the heart, and these are the ones that are specifically designed for contraction. So here is an action potential from a myocardial cell. So this is what? Millivolts versus milliseconds. So this is electrical activity versus time. So this is not a tension measurement. This is an electrical measurement inside of a cell, a myocardial cell for contraction, not a nodal cell. All right. And so we can see that once it's stimulated by an action potential from a neighboring cell, right, coming through a gap junction, right, there's a very rapid depolarization due to voltage-gated sodium channels. Right, now, how does this look different compared to a normal action potential for a neuron? The amplitude is sort of the same, but what about the duration? It's much longer in duration. Okay, and what were you saying? Oh, it doesn't doesn't repolarize quite so fast. Okay, and that's because in the membranes of these cells, it has calcium channels that open slowly, okay, and they stay open. So the calcium now is entering the cell, which is good for excitation-contraction coupling. But when calcium enters the cell, it also maintains depolarization of these myocardial cells. And so this is what we call the plateau phase of an action potential from a myocardial cell. All right, and then finally, these calcium channels close. And what takes over are the open potassium channels, so potassium can leave the cell, and then that repolarizes these cells so that they can be stimulated once again. All right, so what's the beauty of this kind of action potential in the heart? Where should I draw, or can you remember looking at an area called the refractory period, okay, in a neuron? And what is the refractory period in a neuron? What is a refractory period? What happens during the refractory period? Okay, it means that a second action potential, right, can't come along until after the refractory period, right? So action potentials can't summate, all right? And so the nice thing about myocardial tissue is that because of this plateau region right here, the heart can't go into tetanus. Now, do you think that's a nice advantage? Biceps can go into tetanus because they have short action potentials, right? And so the refractory period is relatively short. And so twitches can summate, right? But in the heart, because of this long absolute refractory period, the heart can't go into spasm and just stop contracting. Okay, so I'll show you a superimposed plot with tension. So this is actually good because a heart can't seize. It's always going to be contracting, relaxing, contracting, and relaxing, except for one circumstance that we're going to look at. Okay. So this is a contractile cell. Looks a lot different than a nodal cell. It doesn't have what pacemaker potential. It just has an extended absolute refractory period, so the heart can't seize. Which is absolutely.
So when exactly is the refractory period over there? When it gets back down in there?
Yeah, I would say different books draw it at different locations, but I would say once the membrane potential goes back to the resting membrane potential, all right, then so that whole thing is the refractory period. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so the heart almost has to relax before it can contract again. Okay. So I think this is sort of a review from anatomy. Let me just look at some of these slides right here. Okay, so here's the normal pacemaker of the heart. Okay, and so that's nodal tissue, and all these yellow lines right here, that's nodal tissue. These are specialized for muscle cells that are more specialized for conducting action potentials than for contracting. So action potential from the SA node sweeps over both atria. Okay, and there's no way for that signal to get into the ventricles because of the fibrous skeleton, except that there is some specialized tissue starting here at the atrioventricular node. When it depolarizes, it holds the depolarization signal for a little bit, and then it passes it on to the bundle of His, which is what we call the atrioventricular bundle, and that penetrates the fibrous skeleton and introduces it to the ventricular myocardium. Yeah. Yes. So it takes a little time for that action potential to reach right over here. And when it reaches the AV node holds on to that signal and delays it before it gives it to the ventricle. Okay. But under normal circumstances, all electrical activity of the heart starts here at the SA node. And then it just sweeps down to the AV node. It stays there for a little while, and then it's presented to the ventricles. So does I sort of answer your question? Yeah, okay. All right. Now, if someone had a heart attack in this region of the heart that then destroys or damages the AV node or the bundle of His, right, and when that tissue is dead, it can't conduct electrical impulses, then there's no way for any electrical activity from the atria to reach the ventricles. So then the heart is going to start beating at two different rhythms. One rhythm determined by the SA node, here in the right atrium, and then some other tissue in the ventricle, because it's going to spontaneously depolarize, will then become an ectopic pacemaker for the ventricles. And the ventricles will beat at one rhythm, and the atria will beat at another rhythm. And sometimes that might feel strange to somebody, but it's probably not too big a deal, okay, believe it or not. Okay. All right, so what about now the spread of this action potential down through the AV bundle, all right, down through the bundle branches. Now the action potential spreads very rapidly down the septum to the apical regions of the heart and then finally into the Purkinje fibers, and then that allows action potentials to spread through the ventricular myocardium, then causing contraction. So the atria, because of this delay in the AV node, the atria contract first, and what do? They pump blood into the ventricles, that loads some extra blood into the ventricles, and in those charts that we previously showed you, you could see a little bump in pressure of the ventricle when the atria contract. And then that action potential goes all the way down to the apex of the heart, so the apex starts to contract first, And then contraction works its way up through the septum and the lateral walls of the heart, right? Pumping blood, which way? From the apex, squishing it up toward the base of the heart, then out through the great arteries at the base of the heart, right? So the heart contracts atria first, then ventricles, right? Atria, then ventricles, but in particular, the apical regions of the ventricles first, pushing blood up toward the base of the heart so that it gets out. You can see that it probably wouldn't be very efficient for the basilar regions of the heart to contract first, because it would squeeze blood where? It would squeeze it down into the apex, and it'd have no place to go, and then, I don't know, maybe the heart would explode and there'd be a big mess all over the place, okay? Okay, so the conduction system of the heart coordinates how the heart contracts, and it's very important that it contracts just in that way. Okay. Okay, so here's that time delay in the AV node. Then the speed is very fast down through the bundle branches and through the Purkinje fibers. So you can see that there's a difference in time between when the atria contract and the ventricles contract. Okay, what about excitation-contraction coupling? Right, depolarization of the myocardial cells open voltage-gated calcium channels in the sarcolemma. All right, this depolarizes, or that depolarization opens up voltage-gated and calcium release channels and the calcium-induced calcium release. I think I talked about this in the muscle chapter already. All right, and don't forget, myocardial muscle has troponin, and that allows for sliding of the myofilaments. And then during repolarization, calcium is pumped out of the cell and also back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so here is the refractory period of that myocardial cell, and this is what, not a nodal cell, but this is the contractile cell. So here we see the refractory period all the way from the beginning of depolarization until right when the membrane is repolarized. And there's a short relative refractory period. I don't think I'm going to make much about this relative refractory period, but superimposed on top of this diagram is the muscle twitch that's produced by that myocardial cell. All right, so it's not until this point in time right here that this myocardial cell can be stimulated into contracting again, and it is what, almost already completely relaxed at that time, thus preventing this muscle to go into tetanus. Okay, because of that really long refractory period. Okay, so here we see an electrocardiogram. So you got to know the three main waves on this electrocardiogram. And I think you did some electrocardiography in lab. You put some electrodes on your wrists and ankles, right? So if we were to add together all those millions of action potentials running over the heart, right, that produces a significant amount of electrical activity that we can pick up on the surface of your body. All right, so this is not from one cell, but from what? All the cells of your heart that are summing together. All right, so what chambers of the heart contract first? Yeah, the atria, right? Okay, and we can actually see that on an ECG, this P wave right here, all right, signals the atria to contract, so it's followed very shortly thereafter with atrial contraction. So the P wave, typically, we call that atrial depolarization, right? Atrial depolarization. Now, what's justified on this diagram is what an action potential looks like for a ventricular cell, and notice how long it is, right? Okay, so the P wave happens first, then there's a delay called the PQ interval, and this is due to the delay that's imposed by what, the AV node, right? And then the signal enters the ventricles, and that produces the QRS complex. So the QRS complex represents depolarization of the ventricles. You can see that right there. All right, but it also represents something else. After the atria depolarize, what do they have to do? They have to repolarize, right? So the QRS complex, it also represents repolarization of the atria, but the atria has such little tissue in it compared to both ventricles that it really doesn't stand out. You can't really recognize it. There's no way to deconvolute the signals to use it for any information. But repolarization of the atria is buried within the QRS complex right here. Okay, so you got to say QRS complex is due to two things: depolarization of the ventricles and repolarization of the atria. Okay, and then the T wave represents, what is this right here? This is repolarization of the ventricles. So those are the waves. And I would guess probably they call this the P wave. I'm not sure I know my Latin well enough, but I would guess that's what the primavera wave, that's the first wave. So it's named P. Okay.
I have another question.
Yeah.
In the book, in the talks, when it talks about the time from the P to the Q, the interval, call it the Q interval.
Yeah.
The book is calling it the PR interval. Is that like really a big deal?
No. The PR?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. You could call it either one. Okay. Okay, so ECG and EKG are what? Exactly the same thing, right? Just one is an older, more archaic way of pronouncing it. And in hospitals, you might find signs in one hallway labeled ECG and go to the next hallway and they're going to be what? EKG, right? That's kind of cute the way that is. It just is the same thing. Okay. All right, so here is what we've been talking about. All right, remember the ECG waveforms are not a measure of contraction, right? They're not tension. They're just voltage, right? They are strictly, they're strictly what kind of events?
Electrical
events, that's right, due to calcium channels that are opening, sodium channels, and potassium channels in the membrane. All right, so here's a question. I should use English when I write this stuff. Must have been really late. What do you call a machine that acquires and records an ECG? Let's see if I know the answer to that. What do you call a machine that records an ECG? Okay, that's what we call a electrocardiograph. Okay, it's a graph, G-R-A-P-H. All right. And what do you call a strip of paper with an ECG on it? I should have that's an electrocardiogram. And so it's easy to remember because, well, maybe you haven't used these kinds of things, but there used to be someone could send you information on a telegram. Okay, and a telegram is what? The piece of paper you get. And what kind of machine sends a telegram someplace? That would be a
telegraph,
right? So that's how you would know that those two different kinds of things. Okay, so which events occur first in the heart? The mechanical, which is contraction, or electrical events? All right, yeah, so I'm really kind of hounding you with those things. All right, so here just shows you and a couple really nice colors, probably like red and green or something. Depolarization of both atria forms the P wave. All right, and then there's a delay. And then finally, goes through the AV valve, down the bundle branches, down to the Purkinje fibers in the apical parts of the heart, right? And that's going to cause the QRS complex, okay? And then finally, repolarization of the ventricles. So what do we have? I think I see. So here you have probably one color showing ventricular depolarization. But now, this is probably a nice diagram if it's like this, but now what do you see in the atria? This color probably should be different than this one. Oh, cool. Okay. Because this is showing what? Atrial repolarization. Because that is, I can read, that's this color right here. Okay. That's nice. Okay. All right, so make sure that you can correlate the ECG with mechanical events inside the heart. Okay, and we talked about the heart sounds already. All right, first one is when the AV valves close. The second heart sound is when the semilunar valves, I was going to say aortic semilunar, but it's all the semilunar valves, right? It's the pulmonary as well as the aortic semilunar valve. Okay, structure of blood vessels. Well, I'm not going to take a lot of time, I don't think, to talk about structure of blood vessels, but let's just look at some of these questions to see how much you have to review on your own to really get this information. All right, so material can enter or leave the blood only through what kind of blood vessel? Capillaries, right. Okay, and why is that? Because they are thin. They're very, very thin. Yes, indeed, they're small, but the wall of a capillary is very thin, and there may be some capillaries are not continuous. They even have little holes between the cells, the endothelial cells, so they can actually leak fluid out of them, and that's supposed to be a good thing. Right? So plasma can leave the circulatory system. Not blood cells, not big enough for blood cells, but for fluid. All right? Arteries and veins are way too thick to allow for diffusion. Right? So diffusion can work only under small lengths. All right, so what structure regulates blood flow through a capillary? There is the pre-capillary sphincter, right, that can be adjusted to either shut down blood flow to a capillary bed or it can dilate. All right, name the two mechanisms which help return blood to the heart. So blood is going to flow due to a pressure difference, high pressure to low pressure. Right? In a vein, there's not much of any kind of pressure. It's all low. So how does blood move through a vein back to the heart if there isn't like pressure trying to force it one way or the other? Okay. It's got valves, and arteries don't have valves. Right? Capillaries don't have valves. So blood can actually flow backwards in an artery if something happens. But in a vein has valves because the endothelium of veins have flaps. So blood can never squirt back down to the periphery. It can only move back toward the heart. Okay. So when you contract a muscle, like this biceps right here, what happens to the blood that's in this biceps that turns into this incredibly hard solid? Yeah, it gets squished, it gets pressurized, and which way is it going to squirt? Is it going to squirt back down toward my hand? Is it going to, because the valves in the veins, it can only get pushed back to the heart. Right, so muscle contraction is one of the pumps that returns blood to the heart, and there's something else too, which we haven't talked about yet, but when we get to the respiratory chapter, what allows air to flow into our lungs is that we decrease the pressure inside our thoracic cavity by expanding our rib cage. When we expand our rib cage, the pressure decreases in our lungs, and then so air gets sucked into our lungs. But what else gets sucked into our thoracic cavity? Not only air, but blood also gets sucked back into the thoracic cavity. And where's your heart? In your thoracic cavity, right? So we call that the respiratory pump, right? So the respiratory pump and muscle contraction are the two ways. Name the three types of cardiovascular structures that have valves. Okay, give me one. Veins have valves. The heart has valves. I don't know, venules, I can pass on that one. That's good information, but I can pass on that one. But there's something else too. And you'll have to refer to your anatomy class, but the lymphatic vessels have valves as well. So lymphatic vessels structurally are similar to veins, and lymph is another very low pressure system. And again, lymph is returned to your cardiovascular system due to what? Muscle contraction and respiration as well. Okay? And it has valves. What's the difference between a sphincter and a valve? Like a pre-capillary sphincter. What's it made out of? It's smooth muscle. So when it constricts, it closes that blood vessel. What about valves in the heart? Are they made out of muscle?
No.
No. What are they made out of? Ooh, this is a good... They're made from endothelium, right? It's the inner lining of the heart, right? So valves are passive. They just work by pressure difference. So that's the big difference. So precapillary sphincters can be controlled by events, but these valves are just going to be controlled by pressure in those particular vessels. All right. So here's a nice precapillary sphincter. Okay. Oh. Sort of anticlimactic. That's the end of the chapter. Okay, so go back and so here you can see the valves and veins. Okay, that's the muscle pump versus the respiratory pump. Okay, now this figure that you have in your lab book, I forgot to scan it, and I forgot again today to scan it, but maybe I can remember this afternoon to do that, and I'll put that in Blackboard along with the key so that you know how to label that diagram. So that is an exam figure, Yeah, this figure right here that you have in your lab book, that's a really nice exam figure. Yeah. Yes. And as a matter of fact, you could think of the tunica intima as being only that one layer made of endothelium. Sometimes it has a little connective tissue, but I think you could ignore that. They're almost synonymous. Yeah. Unless you're a histologist, then you'd probably be involved, really excited about some other layers in there that are really, really small. Okay. So endothelium. Yeah. Tunica intima. Okay. All right, so that's it for this chapter. So while I get the next chapter, I don't know, ask me some questions or something. Okay, good clean Scantron. No stray marks. I had a couple students get gypped out of points last time, because they were circling, I think, the number, which is right next to those tick marks on the Scantron. That's what the Scantron reader uses to identify a Scantron and to keep count of everything. You can make marks in that green area, but don't make anything where those tick marks are. And they actually had the right answer, but the Scantron reader gave them a wrong answer. They didn't get credit for it, and I was really mean. I didn't give them credit either, because they had stray marks on there. So you guys shouldn't be making any kinds of funny eraser marks or stray marks on your Scantron anymore. So if you don't have... Okay, why? There we go. Oh, wow. Did it come? No? Aha. Fantastic. Oh, for like today? Online? Last week or up? I think. You know, maybe my recorder wasn't working one time, but I put a link to the other class.
Oh.
So you should be able to get both of them. Yeah. Oh, geez. Sorry. Oh, maybe the caps are on.
No, you only had one meter.
Oh. Oh, okay. Oh, geez, what does it say? You know, they were doing some maintenance over the weekend. And this is the most fun chapter of all of them. I hate to delay it. All right, let me go to the wired keyboard. I think I got in there. Oh, now, what else? On the study guide, I did have you do some quantitative questions at the back of the chapter, okay, which are just basically reading the graph. So you guys should know how to read graphs, okay? So you can practice those. I don't have another copy of the lecture. I don't have another, and I don't even know what this lecture's over. Okay. So we got 20 minutes. Oh, wow, we don't have 20 minutes to give away in here. Ooh. Yeah. Okay, hold on. I got a question. Yeah? Okay, yeah, the strict definition of hematocrit is just red blood cells, the percentage of red blood cells. I think, so I gave you a slide, right, with the volume of white blood cells, the volume of platelets, and the volume of red blood cells, and you should just use the volume of red blood cells to calculate hematocrit. Now, those other volumes are pretty minuscule, and if you were to do it just with your naked eye, you might not be able to tell the difference if you were to include everything. But strictly speaking, it should be red blood cell volume and not those other things in there as well. Okay? Okay. So, oh, I think you dropped your wallet or something there. Maybe. I'm not sure. Okay, let me try it one more time. Okay, so caps lock is not on. All right, who's got a computer in here, and can you log into Blackboard at the moment? You guys with your computers on. Maybe I have to go and take a look. All right, I'll be really careful. Okay, another question. Let's take a question. Yeah. Respiratory. Can I explain respiratory acidosis versus respiratory? Yeah, okay. Respiratory alkalosis, I can. And I think we're going to talk about that when we get into the respiratory chapter, but I think you guys actually know enough to understand that. Was that a question in any of the stuff for... Yeah? Okay. Okay, so here's a discussion of respiratory alkalosis. All right, so you're going to rely on some information that you previously learned, and that is, here is CO2. CO2 dissolves very nicely in plasma. Oxygen doesn't like to dissolve in plasma, therefore we have hemoglobin to transport it. But CO2 can dissolve in plasma and it can diffuse into red blood cells. But when you have CO2 diffusing into the fluid of your blood, plasma or red blood cells, it gets converted to something because there's an enzyme that converts it. And so almost all the CO2 that your body produces can dissolve in your blood because it gets converted to H2CO3. What's that? So here is what? Carbon what? Dioxide. And this is carbonic acid. All right. And then carbonic acid can dissociate. Because it's an acid, it will produce a hydrogen ion plus bicarbonate, HCO3-, and that's just a salt, right? You can dump all kinds of salt into blood. It dissolves into blood, no problem. Okay, and what's the name of the enzyme that interconverts these two? Remember, that's a two-way reaction. It's a bidirectional because what the Gibbs free energy is about the same. There's no release of energy. Who can remember the name of this enzyme that interconverts these two? It's called carbonic anhydrase. Okay, carbonic anhydrase. I'm always wondering if I should have a cumulative final exam. Okay. I can't do it this semester, this is true. Okay, so carbonic anhydrase interconverts CO2. Where does the CO2 come from? Cellular respiration, right? Your body's producing CO2 all the time. Carbonic anhydrase converts it to carbonic acid, it's transported in your blood. All right, and when it's in your blood, it produces hydrogen ions. All right, but don't forget, this is also what, a two-way reaction. Okay. Okay, so respiratory alkalosis. Why do you become alkalotic? Alkalotic means what? It becomes, you're getting rid of these somehow. Okay, it's going to be less. All right, so when you're hyperventilating, what are you doing? You're getting rid of CO2. What we call that blowing CO2 out of your body, right? And when you get rid of CO2, what happens to this reaction right here? Because there's basically no free energy change. That enzyme can interconvert either one. What's going to happen? Then it's going to shift which way? To the left. So hydrogen ions and bicarbonate are going to combine to form carbonic acid, which is going to form CO2. And what principle is that? That's the law of mass action, or you could say Le Chatelier's principle. Okay? So because of Le Chatelier's principle, when you hyperventilate, you get rid of so much CO2 that you deplete your body of hydrogen ions, and we call that a respiratory alkalosis. All right, so you can't change the pH of your body just by hyperventilating, and I don't know if I'd recommend it before the test on Wednesday, but maybe over the weekend or when we get into the respiratory chapter, you might want to rent a DVD, and it's called Andromeda Strain. Have you ever heard of Andromeda Strain? Okay, some people have heard. It's a science fiction movie from a little while back. Oh, they just remade it. Okay, I don't know if they followed some of the true things, but supposedly there was a satellite that went up, and it was supposed to collect something, and it brought it back to Earth, and there was a virus, very bad virus, and it would take living tissue and turn it into plastic immediately, so you would just crystallize and die. Okay, but there were a couple people that were immune to this. There was one baby, okay, because the virus killed its mother, and what does a baby do when it's hungry? It cries, right? And when it's crying, and crying and crying and crying for a couple days on end, what happens to the pH in its body? What's it doing when you're crying? You're hyperventilating, and so that long episode of hyperventilation when the infant was crying produced what? A respiratory alkalosis. It changed the pH so much that the virus was ineffective, right? And it protected the little baby. So that's an interesting movie that kind of reinforces some things you see in physiology class. Okay, so that's respiratory alkalosis due to the carbonic anhydrase reaction. Metabolic acidosis. Okay, metabolic acidosis can happen probably a number of different ways, but something right off the top of my mind is when the Krebs cycle is not operating. Okay, so you can't use sugars through cellular respiration to generate ATP. All right, so what your body tries to do then is to use fatty acids. So you can metabolize fatty acids. Now, show me that we don't need a cumulative final in here. How do you generate ATP? What's the name of the process that can make ATP from fatty acids? Yeah, beta oxidation. All right, everybody's scared. All right, fantastic. Okay. But when there are no sugars in your body, okay, beta oxidation really doesn't work because it donates all of the proceeds of beta oxidation to the Krebs cycle. So Krebs cycle breaks down. So you end up with these. And what are the kinds of fragments that are the end result of beta oxidation? How many carbon fragments? Beta oxidation works at it chops off two carbon fragments at a time, right? So you end up with these two carbon fragments, all right, that your body can't do anything with, so it's going to recombine them to make maybe a three carbon fragment or a four carbon fragment like this, and these are what we call keto acids, all right, like acetones and other kinds of ketones, alpha glutaric acid, right? These are acidic, so when your sugar metabolism breaks down, okay, that can produce what we call a metabolic acidosis because of these keto acids. Now, when is it, this is going to be another test to see if you need a cumulative final. When is it that you can't utilize glucose in your body? When your cells are starving for glucose? Diabetes mellitus, right? Because cells can't import glucose, They're starving for sugar. Their Krebs cycle shuts down. The cells try to generate energy through beta oxidation. Right? So diabetics can actually experience quite severe metabolic acidosis. Right? Their pH can change and become very acidotic. And what would be one way that somebody responds in a metabolic acidosis? How can you get rid of acids in your body? Okay, so for instance, your kidneys will try to work really hard, but what else happens? How can you? You might start to hyperventilate to get rid of the acid just through your normal breathing processes, right? So that might be one thing that can counteract a metabolic acidosis. But a metabolic acidosis is certainly going to override any capacity you have to excrete hydrogen ions through breathing. Okay, you can never breathe really fast enough to get rid of enough acid because you're also getting rid of carbon dioxide. It's going to produce other kinds of vascular changes in your body, which we're going to talk about in the next chapter, which I said is what the most fun chapter in the whole book. Okay, so that's metabolic acidosis and respiratory alkalosis. Can that happen with lactic acid? I'm not so sure. You know, I really think more of in the terms of a buildup of keto acids in the body due to improper glucose metabolism, more so than anaerobic respiration. But it is maybe possible if you're like an extreme athlete. Okay, there are some really strange things that can happen. I had a friend one time. We were going out water skiing, but the boat wasn't. Yeah, one time I had a friend, but one time this friend of mine, we were going to do some water skiing, but the engine on the boat wasn't really strong enough to pull him up out of the water. Okay, but this guy was so strong that he was skiing underwater. Okay, he would not let go of the rope, so the boat was pulling him underneath the water. Okay, and he woke up the next morning and he went to pee and he couldn't really pee. He peed like one drop and it went into the toilet and the whole toilet bowl turned completely bright red. Okay, and so he went to the doctor right away realizing something was really bad and he had rhabdomyolysis. All right, he had exercised his muscles so strongly that they were breaking down, okay, because he was skiing underwater, and releasing phosphocreatine and actin and myosin, and those proteins then were jamming up his kidney, right? So the muscle proteins were so high concentration in his blood that it was plugging up his kidneys, and so they were going to have to put him on dialysis and give him a lot of fluids and things like that. So, you know, you can do strange things to your body depending on whether or not you're a trained athlete, because you can go beyond like the normal bounds that many normal people, you know, most normal people, when you're skiing underwater, what do? You kind of like let go, right? But if you really force yourself, okay, you can produce some kind of abnormal circumstances, like maybe a metabolic acidosis if you really strenuously exercise a muscle, but you have to be a trained athlete, I think, to maybe do something like that, okay? So what did my friend do? Did he get admitted to the hospital? You know, he didn't. He went and bought a keg of beer on the way home and told the physician that he would keep drinking and drinking and drinking and stay well hydrated and take a diuretic all day long. So he didn't have to go into the hospital. But I wouldn't recommend either of those. Okay, breaking down your muscles because you're exercising too hard or drinking a lot of alcohol to keep your kidneys open. That's probably not very good. Okay. Any other questions?
Yes. Muscle relaxation.
Muscle relaxation.
Chapter 12.
Okay.
It says that calcium is moved from the sarcoplasm into the sarcoplasmic reticulum.
Yeah, it's going to go against its concentration gradient.
Does it?
How does it go against a concentration gradient?
Pump.
Got to be an ATP pump.
Well, my question, calcium levels increase anywhere else in muscle relaxation?
No, just extracellular. They're going to go back up and in the sarcoplasmic reticulum.
So extracellular and sarcoplasmic.
Yeah, yeah, because the sarcoplasmic reticulum is just a nice reservoir for calcium when the muscle's at rest. Yeah. Okay, so sign-in sheet. Where's the sign-in? Oh, I didn't pass it around. I did. Oh, thank God. Okay, where's the sign-in sheet? Okay, if you need it, See the lady up there? Okay, one more time. Forget that. Now that I might be able to get to, I can check that before we go. No. Okay, so, I hope I didn't. All right, so there were some questions about the lecture from last week. So we're interested in what? We're interested in 241. And then we're interested Monday, Wednesday, spring. Okay. Okay, I was talking that much already. Oh, you know, I probably didn't change it. But it's probably there. That's probably it.
Oh,
I probably didn't change the label.
Oh, okay.
So that's probably the lecture. So I should go back and relabel it properly. November 2009, it hasn't happened yet. So I got a little sidetracked. Okay. Yeah. Good thing I have it already. Okay, so that's it. If you sign the sign-in sheet, so next time you've got the test over these two chapters. I have no idea. I hope so. That's best for you.
And you're going to put that on.
Yeah.